So it's CHEC is CHECK. It's just an acronym that we use. And I've been working there since 2008, and we essentially do community-based environmental health research. So working with communities to help identify environmental health issues that they feel are the biggest concerns. And so I just want to get an idea of how many people in the room have an idea of what natural gas drilling or the, I guess, the controversies that have ensued around shale gas drilling in the Northeast. Okay, so it's in the news a lot. Well, when we first started working on this issue, it really wasn't. The amount of information that was available was really difficult. So I actually just want to go quickly through. I have nothing to disclose. I don't make enough money. So this is just an idea of the shale plays in the continental U.S. And the Marcellus Shale is in the blue. So it pretty much encompasses a lot of Pennsylvania, Ohio, West Virginia, New York, and even small amounts of Tennessee, Virginia, Maryland, and Kentucky. And then there's a larger play underneath of the Marcellus, which is this Greenland here, and that's deeper within the ground. It's called the Utica, and that's actually an emerging thing that we're going to be looking into in the future. And I just kind of want to describe to you, 2008 was really when the Marcellus Shale exploded, not literally exploded, but exploded in production when companies started to flock there to try and extract natural gas. And that's essentially because there is a significant amount of projected natural gas that is available in this area that is projected. And right now, at current estimates, I mean, depending on how you do your math, the amount of natural gas that's available in this shale play alone could provide 15 years of pretty clean energy. If you're talking about fossil fuels, the comparison between coal, burning coal versus burning natural gas, natural gas is pretty much the cleanest burning fossil fuel. And so we, let's see if we need anything else. I'm going to just kind of describe the process of shale gas drilling. It's a little different, actually, from even other methods of extracting natural gas. Traditionally, what you think of is that you drill straight down and you hit a pocket and it comes out. That's not how this works. The natural gas that we're talking about in shale formations is really stuck within the rock. It's in small pockets. It's very difficult to bring out. So this actually wasn't a feasible, economically feasible way of energy source until recently, because they had to not only develop directional drilling, which means they drill vertically down and then turn it horizontally pretty much in so that it can go through the shale layer and be able to reach more of the natural gas. And what I'm going to kind of explain how it happens, but essentially, oh, can you hear me? Oh, great, thank you. Too many things going on. Essentially the way that they do this is they build the well pad and they bring in the drill. They drill vertically, then horizontally, and to kind of make it pretty cleanly summarized, they pump a lot of water, fluids, some sand, and chemicals into the ground and kind of break apart. It's called hydraulic fracturing. They break apart the shale layer. And this, each time they do this, is roughly about 5 million gallons of fluid injected into the ground. About 10 to 20% of that returns to the surface once the natural gas starts flowing. And so, just some pictures. This is a drilling well pad, I believe, in southwestern Pennsylvania. This is small in size. There are some a lot larger ones. They typically run about 4 to 6 acre well pad size, and they can put multiple wells on that pad. And in some ways, being able to drill out horizontally about a mile underground means that you use less surface, but there is just such a high intensity of drilling that, the balance between the two is tough to determine which would be better, traditional drilling or the horizontal. And so, let's see if we need, let's go to the next slide. I just want to show you some other photos. When I told you 10 to 20% of that fluid returns to the surface, it has to be stored somewhere. That's an impoundment. These are trucks, to give you an idea of size. And this is that actually looks like a waste fluid pond, but it brings up parts of the shale layer itself. heavy metals. There can be some uranium, arsenic, very high amounts of chloride. This is pretty much like 5 times saltier than the ocean. This is a brine solution. It's very salty. And it takes a lot of trucks to bring in all of that water to these rural sites. A lot of them are pretty much located in very rural components of the state and in West Virginia. New York doesn't really have this kind of drilling yet, but it's on the docket for sure. And let's give an idea. So once drilling is complete, what they do is they cap it and then it's considered a complete well. There are things on the site that are left afterwards because the natural gas still continues to return to the surface, the fluids do too, so they have to have things on the site that will separate and capture it so that it's not released. And this is a compressor station. It's from pretty far away, but this is actually a flaring. Sometimes the gas pressure builds up and they have to actually burn it to prevent from something happening like an explosion. And the waste fluids, after they're taken here, there's a couple different things that they can do with them. They can recycle them on site, which is both the economically advantageous for the companies because they don't have to keep trucking in fresh water, but it's also one of the more environmentally friendly options. Some of the other not so environmentally friendly options are they can take them to deep well injection sites. And this means that the waste fluid is pumped out of our system, but it never, nothing really is gone. But it's deep well injected mostly in Ohio at this point. Pennsylvania doesn't really have the capacity to handle deep well injection. What we were doing up until April, May of this year in Pennsylvania was we were allowing the waste fluids to be taken to publicly owned treatment works. This is, your residential wastewater treatment facilities. And commercially owned treatment facilities. And remember, I told you this is really salty, it's got heavy metals, it has things in it that these treatment facilities really weren't capable of handling. And then going through the whole cycle, then the gas has to be cleaned, processed, separated from some of the liquids that return, and then it has to be compressed, that's what the compressor station is, and to be able to put it into pipelines for to be sent to users. So as you can imagine, there are a slew of environmental health concerns associated with that. This is not the focus of my talk today because there was a panel on it yesterday evening, but their slides will be available. It was the 4:30 session in the room next door. One of the speakers was Dr. Tony Ingraffia, if you want to look it up. And so these are some of them. We use a lot of fresh water. It doesn't really come back into the hydrogeologic cycle. There's potential for groundwater contamination. We've seen some methane migration endemic and some other places in Pennsylvania, pretty much from the change underground when they're doing the fracturing. It causes methane to migrate. A lot of when they were using especially the opened waste pits, the chemicals aren't, it's not just separated out. There are volatile organic compounds that are in this waste fluid that vaporize into the air and can be inhalable. You have the potential, and there definitely have been some incidents of explosions, fires, blowouts. There was actually a blowout in Clearfield County, Pennsylvania, right around the time that the Gulf oil spill hadn't been cleaned up yet. And it spewed methane and waste fluids into the air for about 16 hours. And had that ignited and been near a lot of people, it could have been a very significant public health emergency. And we're also starting, actually one of the major concerns that came out first was some of the community and behavioral impacts. And if you think of, it's a sort of the boom and bust cycle of an industry coming in. You have out-of-towners, you have some restrictions on hotels because there's a lot of new people coming in that need that, so it affects tourism. There's lots of money coming into areas that really didn't see this before, so you could have some drug and alcohol-related impacts from that as well. And we actually are starting to gather that data and seeing some of that as well. So, as you can imagine, this really scares the living daylights out of people who are living near them especially. Wells and can be very close to homes based on the regulations that we have in Pennsylvania. Too close, in my opinion, but it's all based on perception. It's based on what you perceive as your risk of being harmed. And, you know, a lot of people, especially at the onset, thought, oh, well, our biggest concerns are wildfires and blowouts. And granted, those are terrible things, but they are not the most common things that we've been seeing in Pennsylvania. What we're seeing more often are worker accidents, slipping into the impoundments because it's really slippery. They can't get out, and it's really noisy on site, so they're not heard, and they could drown. And environmental spills have been a significant problem, mostly with trucks who aren't able to handle the rural roads tipping over and it goes into a surface water site, or even just spills on site that have to be cleaned up by the industry. And what we all know just from public health is that it doesn't really matter what your true risk is. It's kind of the combination of your true risk and what you perceive to be your risk that can really impact your health. Some of these stressors are actually what we are seeing in terms of health impacts as causing a lot of problems with that. Just stress-related and even respiratory, it can complicate respiratory symptoms. And so what we decided was that we cannot have all of this going on in Pennsylvania, and at the time it wasn't really being covered in the news so much, and so people didn't have access to the data they needed. It was being held by industry because they weren't required to disclose a lot of information at that point. They still don't have to fully disclose exactly what they're injecting into the ground. The fluids that they inject are not just fresh water. It can include surfactants, it can include things that inhibit bacteria growth, but we don't have an exact idea of what is being used on every well site, so that can impact both groundwater quality issues as well as public health preparedness. How do you deal with a fire on site if you don't know what chemicals are on there? And so that is changing, especially the worker health issues are changing. But there are still a lot of data gaps, and when we started this program, Frack Tracker was mentioned in my bio, but when we started this, there was really very little data on incidents, accidents, things that were going on. We didn't have that information. The DEP had it in paper form. The Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection had it literally on paper, and it wasn't until we got moving that we were able to start to get some of this data. And how do you make decisions without the information that you need, without the right data, the right information? As scientists, you know, we really push for quality data. We push for access. And if we don't have that, how are we supposed to do our research? Well, think of you're a community member, and you've got to decide whether you want to lease your mineral rights to a company. Well, you're going to make a lot of money, maybe. But what about your neighbors? Their house property might go down. Do you know if this company is safe? Do they have a good record of environmental protection, or are they a wildcat? Have they come there to take your money, drill and leave, and let you deal with the environmental impact? These are tough questions for communities, for municipalities, for regulators. So this is what we worked on. This is called Frack Tracker. And it is essentially just a really great data collection system as well as a mapping system. And it's not set aside for researchers. It's great for researchers, but it wasn't a system that we envisioned only being used by scientists. We wanted the public to be able to access this. And so what this is, it's called fracktracker.org, and it provides open access to data. It's free. And all it requires is a registered email address, and that helps us prevent misuse of the system. And people can upload data that has a GPS or GIS location, so a dot, you know, an address, anything that you can develop a GPS coordinate from. And so what we did was we implemented this first with stakeholders. We talked to the state regulators about what kind of data they had that could be added to the system. What system features would they want to access? And then we moved to bigger stakeholders. We looked at more of a range of environmental organizations and advocacy groups. What do you want to have in this system, and what do you have to contribute? Because it's a public participation system. And it's based on the idea, you guys familiar with Wikipedia, things like that. That relies on a lot of people to validate and provide information on an online public system. You know that you don't go to a, you know, a, put in your report, you don't cite Wikipedia. But it's a great place to start. It's a great place to look at the data, look at the information in a big picture, and understand it conceptually. That's what we base the system on. This was something that was developed by RISA Labs, and then we kind of molded it to fit this issue. Some of the features that are available, and this is something that was brought up when we first introduced the system, was that people were concerned about data quality, and absolutely, I mean, you have to be able to trust what the information is that's on the site. That's why we ask for email addresses, because any information you upload is directly linked to you. You can, there's some subscribe features so people can get notices about when certain information is then available. So here's the attribution. You can see who uploaded the information. And you can also see where the data originated. If it originated with the PADEP, then people are going to be much more likely to trust it. You can rate the system. So if there's a data set that's been uploaded that is a really fantastic resource for air pollution, people who are issued in the air pollution issues around this, you can rate those and sort them so that you can find them later. And you can, with everything on this site, if you're a registered user, you can upload and download all of the information. And that's nice because I don't know how many people in this room have tried to access data from state agencies, but it's really difficult to find, and the data just are in random places on the website, and they're probably not listed very well if they're on there at all. And so those were some of the issues that we were trying to eliminate, making it easy to find and really easy to download. I'm just going to kind of describe what makes this system. So this is considered a base map for those of you who are not GIS inclined. And this just is Southwest Pennsylvania to give you some reference. Here's Pittsburgh. This is the southwest corner of Pennsylvania. And so what you can do with this system is not only do you add data and add information, you can map them. So this is, I've taken a base map layer and I've added a demographics layer. So this is population demographics by census block, poverty rates. The dark red are the higher poverty rate. And this is well known in Southwest Pennsylvania. There are some really rural areas that are having some trouble. Now I've added these blue dots are well permits that have been issued up until just in the year 2011 for drilling. And you can see there's a high cluster here, there's a good number here, there's a bunch of them right here. So it allows us to be able to take demographic data and look at other indicators. These are point indicators. And then I've added green ones, which are the actual drilled wells in 2011 alone, and then be able to look at that. And then you can add it over time. You can do a whole lot of things with the system. So I wanted to, today actually is the first time I'll be talking about this, but we wanted to follow up with some of our users, because it's one thing to provide a system, but how are people actually using it? And I'm going to give you three examples. The first one was a report issued by Penn Environment. They are a policy environmental or advocacy organization, and they wanted to know what the proximity of drilled and permitted wells were to our critical infrastructure and vulnerable populations. And they actually used FrackTracker to find that data and to map it, and it's in their report that you can find. And they actually found 320 daycares, 67 schools, and 9 hospitals, as of the date of that report, located within 2 miles of these wells, permitted wells. And permitted wells, generally, once you receive the permit, they're almost always drilled because of how much it costs to get the permit in the first place. And, you know, that helps policymakers understand, okay, so maybe we should permit, or maybe we should start to look at where these can and cannot be drilled, and how might this affect some of our vulnerable populations. The next one was by GASP. For those who aren't familiar, it's the Group Against Smog and Pollution. They are situated in Pittsburgh, but they work throughout the area. And they were interested, there was an air permit being considered for a compressor station in Fayette County. It's in southwest Pennsylvania as well. And this is the location of the compressor station. And what was being applied, they were applying for an air permit, and they wanted to say that the air emissions that would come from their site should be considered a single source. That was what the facility wanted. And what GASP did was they used FracTracker to map and demonstrate how close all of these are drilled wells, and then there was also a proposed pipeline which was going to be in the area. And all of those can contribute to some significant air pollution issues. It's been shown in Wyoming, for example, that it contributed to wintertime ozone, which is a unique phenomenon. But GASP wanted to work with policy and be able to deny the air permit. It's still being considered. It was originally shut down. The idea of grouping all of these sites into one air permit. And then the next one is actually my organization. We use FracTracker to help identify research sites. And this work's primarily done by the gentleman in the back, Kyle. But we were interested in, at the time, wastewater facilities were permitted to receive the wastewater from the natural gas site. And these are POTWs, these are commercially owned treatment works, and actually that's what this one is. The PA brine treatment accepts 100% of its daily flow is from waste from oil and gas. And we wanted to understand kind of what was coming out of these facilities. Are they doing a good enough job at protecting public health? And what we found was it was not a very good story. There were really high levels of bromide, strontium, barium. 2-butoxyethanol was at 59,000 parts per million, and the standard, what's considered to be a safe level, is 500 parts per billion. And this really was a trigger, we think, and it was presented at the US EPA's Hydraulic Fracturing Study Technical Workshops by our PI at the time. And, you know, it really gets people thinking. I mean, our surface waters are the sources of our drinking water, especially in Pennsylvania. And so what happened was, and this isn't something I can say is definitely the result of our research, but it shows to you what visualizing data and being able to demonstrate proximity and more of the correlations on a visual context, it demonstrates that. So in February 2006, there was a New York Times article on radionuclides coming out of the ground and being part of this wastewater from natural gas drilling. That scared a lot of people, maybe not as much as some of the other things that are coming out should. Radionuclides are probably not our biggest concern at this point, but they should still be, you know, considered. And then we shared that information on the FracTracker site as well. And then in March, our information was shared with the news in the New York Times. And there was also an EPA letter that was sent to the State Department of Environmental Protection discussing some of these issues and recommending that they start looking at restricting the permitting process for it. In March 13th, Carnegie Mellon University found high levels of bromides as well. And this can be a really big issue if you chlorinate your drinking water, because bromides and chlorides, chlorination can create trihalomethanes, which are believed cancer-causing. And so that's something that not only did that study cause some real restrictions on wastewater being dumped into surface waters, but it also changed the way that some of the drinking water facilities were treating the water that was being in the intake. And then on April 13th, the DEP sent a request to the natural gas industry saying, please stop sending your wastewater to our surface water treatment facilities. They're just not able to handle it. At this point, I should say that they're now restricted to 1% of the daily intake, but that we're not sure if compliance is really being demonstrated. Nobody's been able to track it because the DEP doesn't have the authority to go in and say, how much are you accepting? I mean, they can request it, but it's really difficult just based on political issues. So with Fact Tracker, we're following up. We want to understand more about how people use an online mapping and data storage system to make decisions around their health and to make decisions about environmental protection and natural gas drilling. And so we're following up with a user survey that will be sent out soon so that I don't have to just demonstrate some case studies to you. I can actually talk more about the specific data. And these are our partners. Behind's Endowments funded our research and a lot of Fract Tracker.